Welcome to the edit, your edit of what you need to know this week. From the desks of Esquire Middle East, I'm Matthew Baxter-Priest, and as always, joined by my fellow editors, Nasri Atala and William Mullally. We have a lot to talk about today, and I don't have a lot of time to do it in, so let's rattle on through. Hey, how are you guys? You guys good? It feels like it's been a few weeks since we sat and chatted and caught up.
Yeah.
It feels like it's been a few weeks since I've seen you both. Like,
yeah,
you've
been
all
a bit
over
of travel.
The world.
Sure.
I think your time zones, man, you're the one who wins on the time zone Olympics.
No idea what the time zones are, but you know, on if you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple iTunes, neither do you. So, you know, you're just in a dark room somewhere.
Was it you did Singapore and Milwaukee in the same week?
Yeah.
So that's,
I reckon I'm the only person who's ever done Singapore, Dubai, and Milwaukee in a week.
A lot of cultural exchange, Singapore and Milwaukee. Yeah.
I was in Milwaukee for, went to see a Bucks game on behalf of a project that we were doing with Breitling and Giannis.
Yeah.
So Giannis Antetokounmpo, there you go. Got the pronunciation named.
When I had to learn Nurmagomedov last year when we had...
Yeah, when we shot Khabib.
Khabib on the cover, yeah.
Amazing. But what was interesting is didn't know a lot about Milwaukee. Went to Wisconsin and saw... randomly bumped into the statue of the Fonz from Happy Days.
Henry Winkler.
Why is that not more publicly known? That's amazing.
Fonz. Yeah. He was the coolest guy on earth when I was a kid, but then I look at it now, I'm like, you were an old man hanging out with kids. Like, he was way too old to be in that gang.
Yeah.
I don't know, something.
He got them free jukebox use, though.
So, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Didn't he work in a garage?
I think he did, yeah. He did.
That's true.
Yeah, he'd always be like, cleaning up motor oil off his hands.
Yeah.
Giving Richie advice, Potsy, the gang.
Our young listeners are loving this.
Oh yeah,
tell you. Loving.
He's like a 1960s 70s Barney Stinson.
Yeah? Exactly. There you go.
I saw this bumper sticker which I enjoyed, which basically said Milwaukee, home of Happy Days and cannibal serial killers.
Nice Dahmer.
Yeah, and a bit. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah, Dahmer was from here. So, and then everything just got a bit weird
combo.
Mm, you know, but it's got to be famous for something.
Is there food? Does Milwaukee have a
dish? There's cheese and it's a cheese and beer country.
Fair.
So a lot of breweries based out of there and a lot of cheese and like Green Bay is there, and I don't know, like the Packers always wear those big cheese things on their head.
True.
So
I had a very cheese based trip to Switzerland as well. Lots of fondue.
Yeah, amazing.
Oris watch launch. Lots of beer and cheese as well.
You know what? Normally we're We like to kick off with the news, views, and shoes, but I wanna mix this up. I wanna kick off with strong opinions loosely held, which is normally our closing segment. I am not a fan of fondue. Tell me otherwise. Tell me I'm wrong.
I think we probably all agree on this. The thing with fondue is there's a ceremony around it which is cool. Like you're sitting in a nice cozy place. They put the pot and you cut the bread and all of that. Then by the third piece, you're like, this is pretty heavy. Like, I don't think I'm going to, can't do a meal of this. Can someone, I haven't seen a vegetable in a week. Can someone please show me? That's how I felt anyway.
100%. Even like chocolate fondue. It's just, I don't know. It's more, it's the idea of it that matters.
Sure.
And everything else, it's just like.
Sure.
Yeah. No one's walked away from a fondue meal going, I ate just the right amount of food.
Yeah. Fondue and pancakes.
What always got me is, you know, just I love the idea of it. As you said, I'm fine. But then they're like, normally if you go to a restaurant, they're like, pick your assortments of the dipping things that you want.
Right.
And it's like chunks of bread, fine, tick. And like maybe little bits of meat.
Yep.
But you're just meant to dip in the cheese with the fork. What happens if you lose it in the cheese?
Oil, there's an oil one. Plus, why am I cooking?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to cook.
No.
I don't cook at home.
But I love hot pot. That's different.
Hot pot, hot pot I'm into.
Yeah.
What is hot pot?
It's like the same, but instead of cheese, it's like boiling oil, if you will, or like bubbling oil, or you can have it, or a stock broth, basically. Right.
There's a big soup, basically.
Is that more like Korean
style? It's Chinese.
Yeah. Chinese.
It's actually Western Chinese.
Okay.
Yeah. And it became, I think, more of a thing in North Chinese, or in North China. But like, it's just you basically can create the perfect soup putting all the ingredients and cooking them really quickly. It's just, I love things that can be, what can we say, like just beta tested constantly. It's like I'm refining the perfect meal, and every single time I'm like, I can do it better next time.
Yeah.
I just love building to that. I don't feel like I can perfect anything else at any of the restaurants.
Fondue sucks. Hot pot.
Rules. Hot pot in.
I'm definitely trying hot pot.
I'll take you.
Do you guys know about, you guys heard or ever tried a mole? It's in like, it's like a Peruvian or Central American
stew?
Yes, it's like a stew, but it's basically, and there's this, I've been watching Chef's Table or something. There's a very famous restaurant, which I'll put in edit, that has basically just kept this mole going for like, years. And every day they just like add something else in it. And they're like, it needs a bit of this. And they're just keeping it growing. It's like this, it's like a yeast where you make, dough from. It just keeps on growing and keeps like evolving in flavor, and the depths go in. And it's, I'm into that.
Still waiting for its perfect day. That's the thing, yeah.
Yeah. I suppose it's the literal opposite of like too many chefs in the kitchen. If someone's just like, needs salt, needs salt, needs salt. Right. To conclude, fondue. I'm not crazy. Sucks. Fondue is just it's...
We all agree.
Yeah.
So the rules are, though, I have to be super pro fondue. So yeah, fondue. Yeah. The best.
Fondue in Switzerland up a mountain.
Yeah.
That's why you're in Switzerland, though, right?
I had to hike 45 minutes to get to this fondue meal as well, through the snow on a cliff face. I was like, this fondue better be real good.
Even then, it felt too heavy.
And even with literally like 15,000 steps, I looked at my step counter, like 15,000 steps back and forth. I was like, I still feel really heavy.
In the snow, fondue. Uphill both ways.
Yeah, exactly.
What, did you have a car trouble? Or
No. This restaurant, the whole concept is it's in the middle of nowhere. It was Blair Witch vibes at some point. I was saying the brand.
I love the ending of Blair Witch when they have fondue.
Cut scenes, you know? Those are the deleted scenes from Blair Witch.
Yeah, scared the heck
just,
out of me.
Just chefs and gourmands all around the world recoiling in fear. Fondue! Yeah, scarier than death. Excellent. Cool. Well, now we'll jump back into the regular programming. After that lovely short break, we'll come back after this for some news, views, and shoes. Okay, and we're back. Guys, what has been flooding your inboxes, social media, and WhatsApps this week that our audience need to know about, or that I need to know about, really?
I feel like there was like a woman from Texas who ascended to the heavens, and that was all anyone was looking at or talking about. All down at the Atlantis, the Royal, a young woman named Beyonce.
I've heard of her.
Yeah.
I think she's going to go places. I think she's going to do well. Yeah, that was, I was lucky enough to be at that.
At the opening of the new Atlantis Royal.
Atlantis, the Royal.
The Royal, yeah?
Yeah.
Atlantis Royal sounds more like a, you know, like something else. Atlantis with cheese.
It was... What a crazy weekend. It was a lot. It was A-listers from the US, you know, lots of LA vibes, lots of Dubai vibes, lots of London. Like, it was a very mixed kind of, you know, I'd get into the elevator and there was Winston Dukes.
That's the thing. We should have made, like, a bingo card before you went. Yeah. Who you could have possibly run into.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was... I was, you know, I saw Letitia Wright in the elevator, and I was like, "Hey, well, so how about that concert?" You know, like it was such a surreal experience. I mean that whole part of it was surreal, and the concert itself, which is obviously what everyone was like kind of building up to over the course of the couple of days, never really know what to expect. Like, you know, when you're, because it's not like you've bought a ticket to go see something. You're at an event, so it's not like you're going to a concert. Like, people are there for other things as well, and everyone's really dressed up, and then Beyonce emerges, and everyone loses their mind. So, including these people who are A-lister, you know, like, I don't know, you just think people don't get starstruck when they're stars, and you would see these stars getting starstruck, and you're like,
Literally be Black Panther, and you're still sitting there bawling your eyes out.
Exactly, like, everyone was just blown away.
So give me the... Like, give me the skinny on that. Like, what was it? Were people behaving well? Were people behaving bad? Like, was it everyone just a bit like, does the property look dope? Like, what's
So,
give us the juice.
I've been sent a few memes today about people, like, how people, because we weren't supposed to record.
Mm.
And we were told multiple times, here's a pouch. And I thought, I've been to like Dave Chappelle gigs where they put your phone in a pouch, they seal that pouch, and only they can unseal that pouch.
Sure.
So, like, that's what's going to happen. Then they gave us like flimsy cloth pouches to put our phone in ourselves and zip them up. Mm. And I was like, this is not going to work. There's 1,000 influencers here. This is in Dubai. Like, you know, people, you know. So people,
let's have like the richest, most important people in the world rely on the honor system.
Yeah. Within 30 seconds, someone had pulled out their phone. A woman next to me kept chanting, it's for my son. Like, she was being told like to stop filming. She's like, it's for my son. He'll be very angry at me if I don't film Beyonce. I was like, yeah, sure. And they kept going around telling people, you know, please stop filming, please stop filming. Then at some point, just everyone took their phone. It's like the I Am Spartacus moment. Everyone took their phones out. Everyone was Spartacus, and literally, they just gave up.
Standing for the real important, we need to put Beyonce on my Instagram story.
The world needs Beyonce content, yeah. Guys. Like, the world needs Beyonce content.
My there was a line you wrote, like, Elizabeth, and it's really stayed with me. It was about, there were so many influencers just out there influencing.
It was too much.
It's a great line. It's a lot. It's a wonderful line.
You know, at some point I looked around. There was the cast of Dubai Bling, the cast of Selling Sunset, the cast of Made in Chelsea, and I was like, where am I? Why am I here? Like, why? Something. You know, if something happens here, the whole kind of influencer reality TV industrial complex kind of collapses. Mm. If anything happens to this place,
this is also worried. Your Truman Show moment. You're like, wait, am I on a show? And I don't. I'm the only one who's not on a show. That
there
must mean I am on a show.
There were a lot of ring lights going around and. I mean, obviously, like, you know, you still like kind of have to pinch yourself when you're there, like all these beautiful people at this beautiful event, and you know, you're just like lucky to be. Jay-Z walks by, just really surreal.
That's pretty dope, actually.
Very surreal weekend. Yeah, at some point when we were watching it, he was above us on a balcony watching with their kids, like really proud. Mm. And you're like, oh, at the end of the day, it's just like a proud husband. These are proud kids, proud of their mom. Like, it's just really beautiful to see.
Well, I mean, what was the idea that like Beyonce hadn't performed like live
4 years
in 4 years, right? So yeah, the younger like kids and stuff may not have even seen that level of live performance at a gig from her mom, which is like,
and it was epic scale, wild.
Exactly.
It was epic scale because there were probably as many people on stage as there were in the audience. To be honest, like, there was a lot of performers, set design, everything was amazing. And honestly, like for me, I got quite emotional because at some point there was this dance troupe with her, the Mayas or the Mayas, I never knew.
Sure, yeah.
Which is this Lebanese dance troupe that won America's Got Talent, or got very far, or I think won actually America's Got Talent. And they had said, and there was another editor from another title who was there with me, and she had put them on the cover of her magazine. And she said, when I interviewed them, they said their dream was to perform with Beyonce. Hmm. She's like, it's them. So she lost her mind. And everyone got very emotional about that moment. And then they were playing, they played a sample from Feiruz, Beirut. They played Between Us Beaks. So I think for the Arabs in the audience, they're like, what's happening? Because we just expected to see like all the greatest hits and, you know, this amazing performer. Like, and the fact that there was this little kind of local, a nod to where it was happening was really special, I think, for everyone. Plus it looked spectacular. So, sounds, it's kind of hard. Like you're there listening to it. And you have to remind yourself, this is live. Like, this is not a studio record. Does this sound so good? Mm. And how does she sound so good? She's on another level.
Sure.
Yeah, and I feel like, as well, there's also just so many other things that are happening. But, like, were they a part of it? Or was it just, because obviously Nobu's there. Did you see, like, Nobu crying in the crowd, too?
I wasn't next to Nobu. I interviewed Nobu. Well, that was amazing. Before the opening of the new Nobu restaurant and beach club. Interviewed the chef. Actually, didn't really interview this. Had lunch with Chef Jose Andres, who's opening Jaleo. That's my best Spanish pronunciation.
It's beautiful.
And that was really special. He was meant to sit with us for 5 minutes, ended up spending an hour and a half with us, feeding us and pouring our drinks.
By hand.
Almost by hand, literally, like, you know.
Like a mother bird.
It was very Mediterranean. Like, yeah. I felt it was very Mediterranean, hour and a half of just like, enjoying food and life and talking, and he would go off and talk on the phone and come back. Like, you know, it was just very natural, which you're like, this guy is one of the best chefs in the world. Like, right. Why is this so casual? Shouldn't I be more stressed out? And it was just a very, honestly, that might have been, was that and Beyonce that were competing for like the best moment of the weekend.
I mean, they probably didn't have to pay that chef $24 million, but so they'll be furious with that. No, it sounded nuts. And obviously, like, it was the talk of the world almost. Mm. So, you know, that's, but I have one question for you then. Mm. So you stayed there, right?
Yeah.
Well, what are the rooms like? Because everyone was just like, it was all just like Beyonce and the restaurants and these parties and that party and these people. No one's like, actually the hotel looks like this, but is that, Maybe.
I guess everyone took for granted that the hotel would be this like amazing, because it's like being called like ultra luxury resort. So yeah, I mean, it's ultra luxury resort. Like,
how does it differ from, you know, the Atlantis, the Palm next door?
So from what I can tell, like Atlantis, the Palm obviously has like the aquarium and the aqua park, and like it feels like a much more family centric place. Whereas this really feels like a luxury kind of couples retreat. You know, it feels there are lots of like little pools of water in the lobby. And I'm like, oh, this is not kid friendly, and probably intentionally so. Like, sure. I think the way they're positioned is like, this one's where you take your family to have fun, and this one's where you have, you know, your honeymoon or something like that. You know?
Yeah, true. Because the Atlantis, the Palm is so, it's like, it's such a wonderful like family resort.
Yeah.
Like, AquaVenture is just this amazing thing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Definitely not the place that you can be like, yeah, let's just go like chill by the beach.
And it's next door, right? So if you want to do that, you can just pop over. Mm.
The kids are staying at Atlantis, the Palm. We're going to be over here. You guys go hang out with the dolphins. Yeah. We're going to be with Beyonce.
Exactly.
Who is still, she lives here now.
Yeah, I had a moment like my ex-wife went to spent the weekend at Atlantis there, and I was with my kid, and I was like, you know what, I'm gonna go to a water park too. So I took her to Wild Wadi. That's nice. Closed for renovation. Yeah. No mention of that. Maybe that's not something that Jamira particularly pushing in terms of the communication. So I ended up going. I was like, okay, last roll of the dice. Went to La Mer, up in went to the Laguna Water Park. That's but I was like, on the drive there, I went, is that even open still? Because, you know, they're knocking down La Mer, or at least like redeveloping it. So I was like, if I'm about to disappoint this kid like twice in a morning, saying I'm going to two different water parks, and then ending up having to go to Atlantis, the last place that I wanted to be, and I ended days, but it was all right.
Was it open?
The story ends happily. Okay, yeah, yeah, it was. Yeah.
You should go swim with the sharks, though, at Atlantis. that is a good time.
So Atlantis over. What else has been popping in our general conscious this week?
Well, I'm looking forward to this weekend, personally speaking.
Tell me.
Because Hans Zimmer will be performing.
The Hans Zimmer of the music conductor and writer of soundtracks. That's basically what I know him as.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's kind of, I guess, one of the maybe big three, you know, film composers of all time.
Sure.
You know, like John Williams and Ennio Morricone. Like, I feel like he, at this point, a lot of people know his name at this point. Like, he's achieved this rock star status, sure, especially post his Coachella performance, that he, the first time that I met him, kind of was mad at Beyonce to tie these things together, because he kind of feels like Beyonce stole part of his Coachella performance for her Coachella performance.
What, as in like the set or something? Or
yeah, like set.
He was just like, Single Ladies was mine.
Like, he wrote Single Ladies. I mean, that's undeniable. I've seen him do the dance. He does it way better. But no, I think he's managed to step out from behind the curtain? I don't know where I'm going with analogy. But he's become a figure, and people appreciate his music. And I think you watch something like the Inception trailer or Interstellar. Mm. You can't open TikTok without hearing the cornfield chase from Interstellar.
Wow.
Or yeah, the it's so iconic. And if you go through somebody, even things that I didn't even realize, because he's not credited as the composer on like Pirates of the Caribbean, for example, but that theme, he wrote that theme, that's him. Insane degrees. Like,
he's performing
and sold out the Coca-Cola Arena. It's just one of those things. And so much so they had to add a second show. So Friday night he'll be performing the 27th and the 28th. Tickets are still available for that. But yeah, like, could you imagine if I told you this like a year ago? Like,
no.
What if Hans Zimmer came here and we put him in the Coca-Cola Arena? You'd be like, that's a bad idea.
I mean, I could hardly, I stumbled over introducing categorizing him and what he is. Him of the movie making music of the stuff, but yeah, like,
but
to sell out
care.
It. That's it's pretty impressive. How big is Coca-Cola Arena? Like, 25? Someone do a quick little
I'll
Google.
I'll have our research assistant.
We'll get on
my phone.
An update. Sorry, halfway through, I was sold on the Hans Zimmer thing, but I was
astounded.
In the back of my mind, I just had this picture of like Beyonce walking out in like ring attire, like as in like stage attire, like this unbelievable like like outfit, and then Hans Zimmer walking out in the exact same outfit, and just looking at each other, going like, "Hey. Oh, well, one of us is
this is not okay."
Like, yeah, like you know,
they share leotards,
but also
they have a leotard guy.
When did this happen? That because it used to be like film composers were in the shadows, but that sounds ominous. But like they were behind the scenes people, right? And then there was this like inflection point where they became, I guess John Williams was the first to like sell out gigs. Yeah, like you'd go watch him and an orchestra perform. Mm. Whereas it used to just be like you're making this music for a film and it just exists there and you continue your life.
Yeah, but also like I think Hans is just taken to a different level because he'll literally be sitting there at the front doing a guitar solo.
Really?
With, like, screaming crowds. He's not just sitting there just like, hello, I'm a nice composer. He's just, he has fully, like he's this larger than life persona that I think is probably helping elevate the art form in ways that other composers just never had the, you know, ability or maybe
thought
just,
of doing even.
I think it's really fascinating what he's able to do because especially because he's also a composer who I think, I mean, the same way John Williams does, who owes so much not only to the history of film but to the history of like classical music. Mm-hmm. So it's probably, I think it's opened up classical music for new generations in a really interesting way.
Well, okay, so that was my next question, which you kind of covered there partly. It's what's a Hans Zimmer gig like? Like, is he singing? Is it all instrumental? Is it like, is he backed by like an orchestra? Like,
yeah, there's the orchestra. But it's like, it's big and it's epic and it's not just like sitting there. I mean, I think a lot of people thought like this would be at the Dubai Opera, but I think it does feel like a rock concert. Like, it didn't feel out of place at Coachella. Mm. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. And I think like, if that was like the ultimate proof of concept, he's just continued to refine that. But at the end of the day, I feel like he is someone who also is just super cinematic, you know? Like, he is a lover of film. He's a lover of, you know, working with these directors. Like, he's not someone who's just out there just making music, just wanting to be a rock star. Hmm. All these things, I think, are owing to who he works with and, like, what he gains from those people. Like, he loves storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where all of this, like, comes from. Although he's found a way to get that out to the world, I think what it really comes back to is always just a love of movies. And he's just, I think, so passionate about that, which is why he's able to crank out so many all the time. It's just really, I think, fascinating. And I sat down with him yesterday. Mm. We talked for what I thought was 5 minutes, and I looked at the end, and I'm like, oh, that was 35 minutes. Yeah. And really only stopped because he was being dragged to another rehearsal. And he's just, okay, so for example, The Lion King.
I've heard of it.
The Lion King. One of his best scores.
It'll do well, I think.
Oh, no. Beyonce, wasn't that Elton John?
Wasn't Beyonce in The Lion King? Didn't she one of the voices?
In the version we don't talk about.
Yeah, that's true.
But no, that was, like, he's even said himself that he was like, I don't want to do this stupid, you know, Disney animal movie. What is the point of this? And then he actually saw it and realized that it's, you know, this great story about a guy who's dealing with the death of his father. And connected it to the death of his own father and wrote that score as like a requiem to his own father. Sure. So if you think about like that scene when he's, you know, talking to Mufasa and like that epic music is playing, which I think is like some of the best, that specific sequence is like some of the best score work I've ever heard in my life. Like, it moves me every single time. That's just him thinking about his father. And so we're sitting there and at first we're having like a weird conversation because he just got back from Antarctica. And I think he told me that he ate a penguin, but I might have misheard that. It all happened so fast.
I'd rather he ate a penguin than mate a penguin, if that makes sense.
That's also true. He definitely met some penguins, for sure. But I think he just was just like, okay, I'm like, okay, is every single thing inspired by some epic, you know, personal moment? Because he was talking about how Ridley Scott once told him that sentimentality is emotion you haven't earned. And I'm like, okay, so how do you earn all these other, like, what are you connected to? And he's just like, name a person. And I'm just like, Nicholas Roeg, which is like not like a top list of his directors, but he's just like, okay. And he's just like, actually, he was one of my first great teachers. And I'm like, okay, who are your other teachers? And we went through like all these different filmmakers on specific lessons and moments that he had with them, which was just really, really interesting to hear and just the passion that he has for these people. Because, yeah, like, yes, we talked about, you know, Denis Villeneuve and Christopher Nolan, but like Penny Marshall being one of the people, like working on A League of Their Own being one of the like the life-changing things. Pharrell is someone that he's just had these, like he was supposed to, they were going to do the Grammys together and they were going to perform Happy. and they went into the meeting, and they were just like, okay, so you guys aren't just going to perform Happy, right? And they're like, no, of course not. We have a whole plan. And they just came up with the plan off like looking at each other. Just like, and that's what they ended up doing. And you know, it just the life this guy has led just astounds me. But as you know, a lover of film myself, the fact that he has been able to, you know, I think a lot of people always ask him, like, you know, how is your, what is your process? What is this? But at the end of the day, those answers are always boring. But the second he's talking about the people that he's worked with, there's just so much there. And I really wish that I could have just talked to him for another 10 hours, because honestly, that should be a book. He's just a fascinating guy.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, well, let's give our listeners a little bit of the sample of that, and let's hear a clip.
At this point, your biggest contributions to the world of like film scoring are so like well-trodden. Like last time we spoke was for Lion King, and the influence of that beyond just, you know, film music, but you were able to, you know, make kids who weren't even there for the movie cry at Coachella. You're able to, I think, Interstellar.
They weren't kids, we made 60-year-old men cry, you know? Yeah.
No, honestly, yeah, it was, I've only seen the YouTube footage, but it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And every time I watch that, it's...
But you know, actually, it's only recently that I really realized that I really started to do the right thing, you know, by working a lot with Sir David Attenborough on, you know, Blue Planet and Planet Earth and things like this, and realizing that what I am doing, what I'm using my talent for, is to, in a funny way, seduce humanity into believing in itself and to believe in this planet and to believe. I mean, the great thing about what Sir David does is he doesn't cajole us. He doesn't try to bully us into being good about nature and tell us off about how we're polluting everything and everything. He does something quite different. He just makes us fall in love with nature. Mm. You know, and music is a good way to fall in love. I mean, I can't lie. I mean, I have to tell you that, you know, as a teenager, being able to play the piano has its advantages.
No, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, if, you know, Roger Ebert's thing was always that film are empathy machines.
Right.
And you're the fuel which, you know, lights the empathy fire. So that's a terrible metaphor.
Yeah, no. It's a good metaphor.
I mean, it's
a good metaphor. And at the same time, I'm very aware of it. I'm painfully aware of not manipulating and not being. I mean, I remember Ridley Scott once saying to me, "Sentimentality is unearned emotion." Mm. I thought it was a very good way of putting it. So I try to always write music which should feel like a door opening, and the door opens, and it lets you in, and it says, there's a possibility to have an experience. There's a possibility to feel something. But I'm not going to tell you what to feel. You know. So, yes, it's empathy. Yeah, on the whole, it's empathy. But it can be other things. It can be it can be disgust. It can be fear. It can be all these things. You know. It can be trucks. The sound of trucks outside. To me, it's an autonomous language. Mm-hmm. There are certain things. This happens a lot between my girlfriend and me. We're in the middle of a conversation, and suddenly I run out of words, and I, you know, this is what I mean, and I just start playing something. Mm-hmm. Do you mean? Mm-hmm. Because I can express myself better in for certain things. I could.
Mm. I mean, how much are you? Like, obviously, there's the story that you've told 1,000 times about how you didn't really have inspiration for The Lion King, but then you found it in your father. That's obviously one out of, you know, hundreds of movies that you've worked on where you're able
name
to...
any movie.
But, like, is it all about... Is it always about finding the emotion within yourself or the moment within yourself where that emotion exists?
Yeah, yes, because that's the only thing I know how to write about. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean... If you can think of one, name a random movie, and I'll probably tell you something.
Insignificance, Nicholas Roeg.
Okay. The whole idea at the end, you know, and it's very interesting because I wrote the whole end sequence of the atomic bomb going up, and you see Marilyn Monroe going up in flames, etc., and you see the clock lying there. Mm. And I remember before we started Interstellar, Chris had us all look at the movie. And I was just a very young composer. My name wasn't on it. And I could actually turn to Chris and go, you know something? I did that. Which was sort of a moment of being proud. But the thing was, it was, I come from a family of refugees. I come from a family who went through the war. Mm. I come from a family of scientists. I was taught at a very early age, the power of science, the misuse of science, nuclear energy, etc. It can be used for good, it can be used for bad. So that is what I was writing about. So constantly, I wasn't writing about Marilyn Monroe or Albert Einstein or Joe DiMaggio or Senator McCarthy, who are really the main protagonists in the movie, right? But do you know it? Because they mean nothing to me. Mm. But weirdly, the Native American guy who's standing there, I don't know, he moved me somehow. Sometimes I don't know what it is, but there are things which, and Nick, it's just, Nick was one of my first teachers. He really was one of my first teachers.
What did he teach you?
He taught me for a big lesson. I remember he came in and he wanted to hear something, and I said, no, it's not ready, it's not perfect yet. Mm. And he just looked at me and he goes, only Allah is perfect.
Mm, really?
Yes. And I realized he's going, he was saying, no, play it now, be courageous, play it, there's always another chance to go, to get better, but never, don't have the courage not to play things.
Mm. Okay, can we go through them? Like, who are the other big teachers? Like, what are the lessons that most come up in your mind?
Big teachers. Penny Marshall.
Really?
I did League of Their Own with her, which is a film set in the 40s. It's all women, other than Tom Hanks, who has a small role, really.
He gets the famous quote.
He's got the famous line, there's no crying in baseball. But I said to Penny, I know nothing about the 40s, I know nothing about baseball, I know nothing about America, and I know nothing about jazz music. Mm-hmm. And she goes, exactly. That's why I want you to do it. Let's go and explore. So, people who take a chance on you because they know that you're a bit of an explorer. And I used to say to her, Penny, how do you make a good movie? I would use her. I would use her. I would absolutely use her, because she was so smart. Mm. She said, make a good movie. It's easy. All you have to do is protect your main actor. Because he's protect your protagonist, because don't let him say anything stupid. Don't let him wear anything stupid. Make sure he's got, the hair fits the role, etc. Because if you focus on the character, on who that character is, the story will group itself around the character. Mm. And if you think about it, some of the things she did, it's like I said to her, Awakenings. Robin Williams, Robert De Niro. So you gave Robert De Niro the funny role and Robin is the serious role. Why did you do that? She goes, because I know they could and nobody had ever asked them to. And I knew they were going to bring something to it that nobody expected. Mm. So things like that. I mean, Penny was a great teacher. God, there's so many. Stephen Frears, My Beautiful Laundrette. I mean, I loved that movie. I mean,
also, that was like your third movie or something, right?
Yeah, and and there was a young actor called Daniel Day-Lewis nobody had ever heard of in it. Simple things like My Beautiful Laundrette. We had no money. It didn't matter. We had ingenuity, we had imagination. We managed to make something. Ridley Scott, a thousand things I learned from Ridley, but one of them, I remember my first theme for Thelma and Louise was not very good. And he listened to it, and it was on a Saturday. He listened to it. He said, "I'll come back on Monday." That's all he said. All right. So I worked all weekend, and then I gave him the theme that's in the movie now, and he just went, "Sometimes fear's a good motivator." I don't know. I mean, they're all. John Schlesinger, I mean, he used to go and, you know, we used to have deep, meaningful conversations about music, you know, because he knew so much. Jim Brooks, a man who can write comedy like nobody else, you know, I mean, don't sell crazy here, we're all stocked up. Or how do you write women so well? Well, I think of a man and I'd take away reason and accountability. You know, I mean, lines like that, you know. And I watch Jim work. I mean, he's one of my best friends. You know, I watch him work, and I watch him. How hard it's so hard for him to come up with such genius that sounds so easy, and then the movie is like 5 hours long or something. And I remember just sitting there and watching him throw an hour and a half of priceless jokes into the bin, into the toilet. And I can't even tell a joke, you know, let alone write one, you know. And I watch how these people do. I don't know. It's. I don't think there's a director I didn't come away having learned something.
Cool, man. Well, that was fascinating. Thanks for that. So Hans is down, and
we still got tickets.
We can still get tickets to Saturday. So
Saturday.
Friday, okay. The 27th, sold out completely.
17,000, by the way. I checked capacity. 17,000.
So 17,000 seats have been sold. We still have some available for the Saturday night show.
Okay.
But in the meantime, as we lead up to that, I'll be publishing my full interview with him in both written form and hopefully video. At least I'll be posting some clips on Esquire Middle East social media.
Sure.
To see some of the amazing conversation I had with Hans that will gear you up to, I think, what's going to be a fantastic show.
Awesome, man. Well, look, I look forward to reading, listening. I will not be attending the gig, unfortunately. I'm busy, but I will. Maybe it's the next day, actually. It's two nights, right? So,
yeah. So the lad the third.
You know?
If it's so crazy.
just permanent residence.
Yep, into it, and fascinating to know and be able to learn more. So, guys, unfortunately, I got to shoot off today.
Cool.
A little bit early. Hope you guys enjoyed this issue of the edit. Where can everyone find and follow and digest your brains, guys?
I don't know if you want to digest my brains, but if you do, I'm on...
Speaking of The Last of Us.
Yeah, speaking of The Last of Us. We'll talk about that next week, I think. I'm at
Nazri. Oh, actually, tell you what, let's go Last of Us, because just...
Shall we?
Yeah, I mean, this is delicious.
Another zombie joke.
Right?
Yeah, another zombie joke.
I'm in there. The,
yeah,
like, I was a big fan of the game. A little bit kind of sad that, you know, Ellen Page is not in, or Elliot Page is not in... In the show that I'm aware of so far. I've only seen the first couple of episodes. So where are you guys on The Last of Us, and why has it been such a success? I know the stories are doing well for us on EsquireME.com. What's appealing to you guys about it, and why do you think it's caught fire?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, because I was talking to Craig Mazin, who I think obviously just hiring really good people who are able to take a story which I think a lot of people consider like the greatest video game story ever told.
Sure.
Like, it's not just... great gameplay. Like, it's just very involving, very emotional.
Yeah, it's like cinematic playing, right?
Very different, but in a way that I don't think any other game has really captured.
Sure.
You can say that Naughty Dog's same, like, Uncharted series gets there, too. Like, that's kind of the template that they built upon. But that we've already seen Indiana Jones. That's a better movie version of that.
Yeah,
there isn't a better show version of this.
Yeah, and we saw the film.
We love you, Tom.
Did we? I didn't.
Yeah, good. Good.
Yeah, the last, like, a friend, because I'm not a gamer at all, or haven't been in a long time, and a friend had told me, Danny had told me, I guess like 5-6 years ago, he's like, if you're going to play one game, play The Last of Us, because like, you'll actually enjoy this. The storytelling is so good. It's so cinematic. It's really a story. It's not just a game. Like, there's a lot of thought has been put into, so I think obviously I never played it, but But I've been loving, I've watched the first two episodes and I'm really, really, really enjoying it. And I think it must be also like that source material is so good that it allows the adaptation to be this good. Mm. It's obviously really adapting, I don't know.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
We'll see Super Mario later this year, but you know.
I think it's being made with, like, we have the co-creators are Neil Druckmann, who is the co-president of Naughty Dog, who wrote the game, and also Craig, who's made Chernobyl.
Mm.
And so I think both of them coming at it from like a love for the source material, but also like a love for just good storytelling and TV, and not just trying to sit there and like recreate something like Zack Snyder with Watchmen. Mm. They're willing to make changes to make something fit a different medium, because obviously there's an emotionality to playing a game when you are that character that you don't have on TV.
Absolutely.
But you also have the ability to tell stories in a different way, to jump times. And I think the biggest difference we're going to see is in this upcoming third episode, which I've seen, but I will not say anything about. But even Craig himself told me that he thinks this is going to be potentially, I mean, it's the episode that he is most interested in seeing how people react. He has no idea how anyone's going to react to it.
Sure.
Like, people that have seen it have said very positive things, but these are also, a lot of times, there's gamers who were mad at the first episode because one of them was sitting on the wrong side of the couch in one of the scenes.
Amazing.
So how people are going to take a pretty drastic change is going to be very interesting to watch.
Mm.
But personally, I thought this was the best and the most emotional episode, and the episode that I've been thinking the most about since I watched it.
Mm.
And I think I'm really interested to see what you two are going to think of this.
Was the person who was upset about the sofa positioning, was that a guy called Sheldon Cooper? By any chance?
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, listen, bro, just play the game again. It's still there.
Yeah, exactly.
That the one you want exists.
Yeah.
But
yeah, like, this is a different interpretation of a story. Like, that's what I don't get, is like people want a shot for shot. You know, that's not how this works. Like, that's not why would you make it? Why would you make a TV show if you're just going to repeat the video game?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's going to be not only interesting to watch, how they're able to make small changes along the way, but especially as we get deeper into the second game and all these different spin-offs, there are a lot of things that are going to have to continue to change just because it's just not going to work doing it that way. You know what I mean? So it's not like, even if you wanted to create this perfect, version of the game that you have, it's not possible. So
plus, what is it with Pedro Pascal and these like roles where, shepherding a young, a young protege through the world? Because that's who plays in Mandalorian, right, as well?
Yeah, I mean, I just
if
wish
that's
that
him under the suit, which no one does.
Yeah, no.
I wish that everyone hadn't made him aware that he's hot. I hate that. I'm so tired of it. Like, the word daddy should just exit all language.
I heard someone say he looks like Burt Reynolds in this.
Yeah, which, you know what?
I can see. Like, at first I was like, no, he doesn't. Then I was like, hang on. Maybe he does look like Burt Reynolds.
Listen, I wonder if you're casting him. He's just like, he needs to have a mustache.
He
looks better in a mustache.
Yeah, yeah.
When it's not there, I care less.
A lot has been
which
said
says
about,
a lot about a man.
A lot of the content has been centered on his how to get the jacket he's wearing, how to get the boots he's wearing.
Sure.
I think it's like a pretty decent like post-apocalyptic wardrobe as well.
Sure.
Yeah, the answer being trade a bunch of time-in cards from the job that you had, and then
raid the Macy's when you're off on a mission.
Oh, for sure.
Abandoned
nothing pieces. Better than abandoned 20-year-old.
Look, Macy's. I mean, off the back of this, I'm pretty certain you'll be reading that story on EsquireMA.com soon. Where can you get best of post-apocalyptic wardrobes? Where are you buying the boots? Where are you buying the pants from? That's the key.
He has a nice watch. I have to figure out what it is as well.
Right, on it. Well, cool, dudes. Look, I've sadly got to cut this one slightly shorter this week. Thank you so much for your time. As always, fonts of knowledge and a bag of fun. So thank you, guys. Have a good week, and we'll catch up soon.
Cool.
I'll play you up by singing the Lion King theme. Okay, one, two, three.
Cut.